Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. Dr. Chris McCusker, who is an associate professor of history here at MTSU, has been awarded a 2-year grant from the National Institutes of Health to study public health issues and political power as they collided or merged, depending on your point of view, during a critical period in the American South, 1918 to 1945. The title of her research is going to be Just Enough to Put Him Away Decent, The Management of Death and the Evolution of Public Health Policy in the South. It's a book under option by the University of Illinois Press. And we're going to talk to Chris today about how she intends to go about doing her research and what kind of an approach she's going to take to this subject. Thanks for being with here us here today, Chris.
Thank you very much.
One of the things that you said in your abstract was that it's going to be interdisciplinary, and you're going to include history, folklore, and cultural anthropology as you explore this subject of how the South's attitude toward public health or the incursion of public health policy into the South happened during this time period. How do you intend to merge or blend all of those disciplines?
Well, the real focus of the book is on Southern death rituals in the what's called the interwar era, so 1918 to 1945, as you said. And so with the focus on the everyday life, on the everyday practices of Southern habits of dealing with death, because death rates seem to have been higher in the South until the New Deal started to do some of its stuff during the late 1930s, and we can talk about that later. Death is not a subject that historians talk about. We talk about dead people. We don't want to talk about death itself. And so it's required me to fall back on my background from Indiana University, where I earned my PhD in 2000. And I have a PhD in history and folklore and ethnomusicology. And folklorists who are very much influenced by cultural anthropologists look at that study of everyday life, and everything in it matters. That it doesn't matter how small or insignificant something seems, every part of everyday life should be focused on, should be studied, should be understood. There are very few studies about American death rituals. There are even fewer studies of Southern death rituals. And so I've had to sort of take those methods and approaches from these different disciplines. So, for example, for ethnomusicologists, I know I need to look at funeral music. And one of the things that I have found already in funeral ledgers is that there's a shift in music starting in 1943. And before 1943, there people sang Baptist and Methodist hymns from the major hymnals.
Nearer My God to Thee and things like that.
They sang that, but in the Sweet By and By was very popular. Old Rugged Cross was very popular. There's a whole genre of funeral music that was considered appropriate in a Cokesbury hymnal. In 1943, there are four examples in which they begin to mix romantic Western art music in, particularly Brahms' Lullaby and the Meditation from Mendelssohn. And starting June 13th, 1944, every fifth or every sixth funeral has that Western art music in it. But what's interesting is that they don't get rid of Old Rugged Cross or In the Sweet By and By or In the Garden. They mix them together. So what I need to understand then as an historian is what causes the shift. The ethnomusicologist in me tells me to go look for the shift in the first place.
Why do historians shy away from examining death, as you alluded to earlier?
I don't know. A friend of mine said to me a couple months ago, as I was telling her a story that was rather gruesome, but very interesting. She said, you know, I know you find this all very interesting and everything, but just so you know, you're in a really weird place right now. And we see it as being, Americans see death in general as being morbid and weird and odd. And to talk about death when part of the historical processes has been to eliminate death from our everyday lives. As a medical person said to me one day, you know, it's like they think death is optional now. And it's not.
But it's certainly a part of what military historians do. You can't just study war without studying death, can you? I mean, that's what people do. They die in war.
It's amazing how much they talk about this many people died, but they just died and nothing else happened. So for me, one of the most interesting parts of the story that I've found so far is that it's not just been the New Deal that has changed the way people understand life and death in the South and good health, that it's been World War II as well. And so some of the more fascinating stories have been about how the dead are understood in the South when they've been killed on a World War II battlefield. So one quick story, a young man, Olin Dorn Jr., was born in the upper western parts of South Carolina, grew up there, went to what is now Clemson University, and then went into the military as a captain and was killed at the Battle of the Bulge in November 1944. His family received pictures from a friend who went to the cemetery that he was buried in Belgium and took pictures of all the crosses, and then took a picture of his cross with some of the other crosses in the area. Well, behind his cross, because Christians in the military were buried with crosses, is a Star of David, because somebody Jewish died and he wasn't going to be buried with a cross. Right. He was going to be buried with the Star of David. And here's a picture being sent to a Southern Methodist family who's been raised to believe that people bury their own with their own, and their own is someone who is related by kin, mm-hmm, and by religion. And this son of theirs has been buried in a field very carefully, very precisely, but with other people of other faiths. And so I have to understand what that means then, because that care of the dead, it's very precise. It is very honorable. There's a sense of nobility in caring for the dead and caring for the families that I had never known about until I'd read this, because military historians stop with the moment of death.
Yeah.
They don't follow through with the death care afterward.
There's also a difference in the religions. Is some fundamentalist Christians believe that there is no way that someone who does not believe that Jesus Christ is the Redeemer, the Savior, mm-hmm, is ever going to go to heaven, which is what they, mm-hmm, would believe about a Jewish individual. And the Jewish people had their own cemeteries in the United States for the longest period of time because they couldn't get their dead buried in a cemetery with everybody else.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, and one of the things I am finding are those diverse cemeteries. In Richmond, Virginia, there is a Jewish cemetery. There is a Protestant cemetery. You know, and so people will be divided in death as well as in life. Well, the military can't do that in the circumstances in a war where they're moving very quickly. A lot of people are dying very fast. 17,000 young men were buried in that cemetery. And they need to care for them quickly, efficiently, and with honor, and then move on.
I wonder also if having one's war dead die overseas transformed the way Southerners viewed death, in that in the time period you're examining, there would still have been around people who remember the Civil War or, mm-hmm, at least Reconstruction, mm-hmm, and that is a situation in which people died on American soil. A lot of Southerners bled and died on their own home territory, and I'm wondering also if that transformed the way that Southerners viewed death.
Well, I think you have to go back to World War I, actually. 120,000 American soldiers died during World War I, the majority of them through disease. A far lower number were killed in action, although they're certainly there. And it's nowhere near the numbers that the Germans and the British suffered, you know, 1 million, 1.5 million, somewhere in that range. And so some of those questions had already been answered during World War I. Here are our boys who are fighting in a war, and they're fighting someplace other than our territory, and the federal government has asked them to do this. And so there are people who remember Reconstruction. There are people who remember Civil War in that era. And so the care of the dead by the various state organizations is very interesting. So, for example, in Georgia, they wrote a book, and it was a book about the cemeteries in France. And the emphasis in the language is, look how well they care for our dead. Here are the people who are actually doing it. Here are the pictures of the young men who are buried there. And so in some ways, there had already been a transition from that mm-hmm. because of World War One. Certainly the necessity, the greater manpower needs during World War II is going to be far more significant. 10 million serve during World War II, 600,000 die, whereas it's a couple million during World War I. So it doesn't have as much of the expansiveness or influence, I think. But I think World War II was a little easier to handle for them because World War I had already happened
okay.
and already helped make some of those transitions possible.
What about the Great Depression? Dying for your country is one thing,
mm-hmm.
and the war dead are buried with the nobility and the respect that they deserve. But dying because you are a hardworking, upright individual who just wants to get an honest day's pay for an honest day's work, and you can't find a job. And you die either because the stress has debilitated your immune system, or you die of hunger, or you die because you are so depressed and discouraged that you commit suicide, feeling that you've been abandoned by both your country and your God.
Mm-hmm.
It's a situation that's bound to shake people to the core. How did the Depression change the way people think about death?
Well, you know, that was the story I expected to find, and certainly with this grant, it's 2 years worth of research, and I'm 3 weeks into it.
Yeah.
So I still have another 13 weeks to go.
Yeah.
So I can't exactly answer that yet.
Yeah.
But
as a historian, you can't really say anything. I'm thinking just in terms of anecdotally,
sure.
but you've got your work ahead of you.
Well, that's part of it, but because historians, I can't say anything unless I have a document in front of me from that moment in time.
Right.
But what I can tell you is this, is that when the New Deal started to do stuff in the South, and the South in the 1930s was considered the nation's number one economic problem, the New Deal was able to do things about health and wellness that caused people to simply stop dying. So the story is actually an opposite one. We expect to find suicides and depressions and all this, and what we find is that death rates begin to drop so substantially that newspapers in Memphis and Murfreesboro and other places are mentioning it and writing stories about it. And it's significant enough that in 1935, an editorial was written in the main Richmond, Virginia newspaper that was an obituary for three men who had died at the age of 90 within the previous 2 or 3 weeks. And it said, you know what? We live in a new world right now. We used to get, according to the Bible, a lifespan of 70, or if you were really strong, 40. What happens if we live in a world where you get 70 or more? And so people aren't expecting to live longer, and yet when they do, they don't know what to do with it in some cases. So that's one of the stories that I've found. Another story that I've found is that the three main causes of death in the South, with the end of the malarial and typhus and yellow fever epidemics, which was about 1905, 1910, the three main causes of death were TB, tuberculosis, pneumonia, and infant and maternal mortality, which were excessive. I took a funeral book from Memphis. It was a white funeral home, the National Funeral Home. And in 1938, 26% of its business was babies under the age of one.
Wow.
In 1941, it was 3%.
Mm.
Something changes that causes babies not to die so much. And to have an expectation that your children should live beyond the first year of age or second year of age. And it stays there for a little while until military mobilization and people start moving around the country, and then the infant mortality rates go up to about 5 or 6% of this particular ledger's business.
Mm-hmm.
But and so what happens, the question is, what changes so that people aren't dying so quickly at birth, for example? Well, the WPA and the Civilian Conservation Corps go out into people's towns and small towns, and they start cleaning ditches, and they get rid of mosquitoes. They build proper sanitation So there's good plumbing now. When they built McFadden, the city stopped its sewer pipes and its electrical wires at the city limit. So McFadden and that area over there didn't have sewer pipes and electricity until the WPA and the Public Works Administration came in and built those things.
Yeah.
And so that's what the WPA did, is came in and brought good health through proper sanitation, through cleaning up the drainage issues in this area, which were significant. And then they did something real simple. They started building hospitals. The biggest one in this area, of course, would be the VA.
Right.
But they built those everywhere. Substantial number of hospitals. And so there were places to be healthy and well, or to get healthy and get well, that hadn't been there before.
It does also stand to reason that personal hygiene habits would improve when you've got indoor plumbing and you can actually wash your hands and take a shower and wash your hair in the house.
Well, it's especially with bathroom sanitation.
Yeah.
That would have been a real issue. One of the really interesting ways, though, that the New Deal interacted directly with death care, and when I say death care, because that's my primary focus, mm-hmm. is the burial of the dead, the grieving one does over the death, and the comfort given to the mourning. That the New Deal, the Tennessee Valley Authority especially, had to move about 10 or 12,000 graves to build this network of dams throughout the area, Tennessee River area.
And moving the dead is touchy business.
It turned out to be a lot less touchy than I thought. So at Norris Dam, for example, they had to move 5,000 bodies. And there was one pastor who had some problems with it, had some real problems with it. Mm-hmm. But they received letters, they received comments from the families whose kin were reburied. Thank you. You were very honorable. And I think what they did is that they applied these military sort of traditions to the reburial of these dead. And then what they did at the same time, you know, families used to bury their dead on their family farms.
Mm-hmm.
So there's thousands of cemeteries across the South and other rural areas as well. But they taught Southerners, at least up near the Norris Dam area, how to centralize their burial practices, which they hadn't done before.
Right.
And so that was a story that I wasn't expecting to find either.
Now, this respect that you're talking about, mm-hmm. and the gratitude of the Native people runs counter to the way that the TVA has been depicted mm-hmm. in popular culture, in movies and on television, as just this big, roughshod federal juggernaut who comes in and drives grandma off her property and says, you know, this is for your own good, and she's out there with a shotgun trying to defend decades of tradition. This runs totally counter to that image.
Well, that's the Lee Remick movie that about this one woman who was in her 50s or 60s, and it was that particular story was about the land acquisitions
right.
for these things. And so if you look at the land acquisitions and taking the land to build these dams, mm-hmm. that story fits that narrative a lot better.
There was an episode of The Waldrons that also ran along this same line.
Okay, yeah. But if you look at the care of the, and in some ways there's a way that the care of the dead is something the federal government has always done well, because it's always been fighting wars, Spanish-American War, World War I, Civil War, and has had to care for the dead. And so there's a way that there's a sort of etiquette already there.
Mm-hmm.
So with the exception of this one pastor who had issues with this, and it was not widespread, the vast majority were compliant and willing. And in one case down in Chattanooga, I don't remember the name of the dam, Wheeling, it might be Wheeling, but the man wrote the New Deal or the TVA and said, yeah, it's okay to rebury my wife and daughter who died 20 years ago from the family cemetery, from the family farm, but I want to modernize. He doesn't say it that way, but I want to move them to a forest lawn type cemetery in Chattanooga. Now, these forest lawn, what I mean by that is that it's a cemetery that is a park-like atmosphere where there's picnic or park benches and trees and grass, and you're supposed to go there, and it's not supposed to be about being dead there, really, mm-hmm. even though there's people who are dead in the ground there. The whole idea is to make death seem really sanitized and really It's disappeared. Mm-hmm. It's a park. It's a bucolic area. And he decided he wanted his family in that sort of more modern arrangements. And so the TVA allowed him to modernize the way he cared. He did his death care. So it's because I have to work from the sources become very contradictory in some ways.
Right. I'm wondering if there was a touchiness in that era with Southerners about disturbing a grave the way that there is now with some people. Take, for example, some folks can't fathom a body being exhumed, even if it is for the purposes of discovering the true cause of death, or if there's some question as to whether there was a homicide or a suicide involved.
Meriwether Lewis. Yeah.
Yeah. And also, some people cannot fathom having their loved one's body autopsied. Mm-hmm. They can't imagine cutting into the body and everything. Now, you know, biologically, we know that there's nothing wrong with this, but there's something that touches these people very deeply into their soul, that their loved one is being mutilated it strikes at the very core of their ethics and their morals. Does that transcend time, do you think? Is that something that it did not change with the New Deal?
Well, I think that what happens is that the body matters, and it's a whole body. And the body rooted you to your land. So when you had a family cemetery, when the federal government was trying to buy the land that would become Cades Cove and Smoky Mountain National Park, one of the reactions was, they're asking us to sell our dead. Because what they were saying is that this is our family, dead and alive, and they come with us. We come with them. And so there's a sense of the sanctity of the body once it is dead and once it has been buried. And that is something that does indeed transcend time, because so far, and what I've found is that in Christian theology, the whole body matters. Now, that's going to change when embalming practices become more and more common,
right?
Because the whole body is going to matter, but is it the whole body that is preserved to go to heaven, or is it the whole body that becomes ashes to ashes and dust to dust?
You're not just putting somebody in a box and putting them 6 feet under anymore. It's a little more complicated than that.
Exactly. And a lot of the stories that I've been hearing from people are about, you know, sitting up with the dead overnight. And I was at Adam's place yesterday, and one of them said, well, you know why we sat up with the dead? That's back in the days when there were no screens on the windows. And we had to keep the cats off the bodies.
Uh-huh.
And so it's all about making sure the body is whole. That's why the cremation rates are non-existent in this era. I've looked at about 25,000 records. There are two cremations.
Wow.
It's why organ donations in the South have always been far lower than other places. And so that whole body matters. Now, here's the sort of awkward side of it, and some of your audience may want to listen away for a second because this is a relatively gruesome story. But Air Force training military places during World War II caused a lot of problems in this regard, because when there was an airplane crash, it was a catastrophic event on the bodies. And this is a story that Professor Emeritus of Political Science, Frank Essex, told me, because his dad had the Stuttgart Air Force Base in Arkansas. Mm-hmm. He had the funeral director contract.
Yes.
So here's a body on which catastrophic damage has happened. There's nothing to embalm because there's no vascular system left. So how do you recreate a body that's necessary for burial? Because when you see Jesus for that first time, you have to have the whole body together, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so what he said is that they began to tie the shirt around the neck that no longer existed with the tie up there, and buckle the belt where there was no torso left, and mm-hmm. put the socks into the pants, that they used clothing to recreate a body that was no longer there.
Yes.
And so it causes some really significant contradictions with these new embalming practices, with the airplane crashes, and other kinds of industrial accidents that will also do that sort of catastrophic damage.
A very severe car crash could do the same thing, couldn't it?
And those car crashes don't begin to happen until the 1920s. Okay, so that's another thing that the New Deal has to deal with is here's a South that hasn't really done a great job in building its roads, and so there's a lot of car accidents.
To say nothing of a lot of moonshine and the birth of NASCAR on what initially were dirt roads.
Exactly. And in fact, the title of the book, Just Enough to Put Them Away Decent, comes from a WPA life history. They used to do oral interviews as a way to put people to work under the Federal Writers Project. And so this one woman was interviewed, Mrs. Omi Williams Epps. And she begged her husband when they lived outside of Augusta, Georgia, and they had 13 kids, and she wanted to move to town because she wanted her kids to get education. And he said, well, fine, we can move to town, but I'll bet you, just sure as we move there, one of those kids is going to get killed. And sure enough, they lived there for 3 years, and a car came through the front yard and killed their second youngest son. Couple years after that, Mr. Epps, who was an airplane pilot, one of the first airplane pilots probably in his area, was killed in an airplane accident, leaving burial insurance that was just enough to put him away decent, she said.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if with all of these changes in the way people are actually put away, quote-unquote, mm-hmm. decent or otherwise, if this is the era in which government regulation of the funeral industry started to take place so that people wouldn't get snookered or that people could be rest assured that they wouldn't get gypped to have their loved one entombed properly.
Well, it's an interesting story because they don't really start requiring death certificates in Tennessee, at least until 1908. And that in fact, if you were going to be a licensed embalmer, it was the funeral directors themselves who were the catalysts for that. They wanted to declare themselves a profession. They wanted to set the standards and say, these folks get to be embalmers and nobody else gets to. The egregious stories about families spending too much money on funerals and stuff are relatively rare in this era. It's a cross-class, cross-racial study, and there's some... there's one story from a black family in Kentucky where the funeral director sat there and, oh, yeah, we'll get you something within your price range. And then every time they would go to choose something like the coffin, he'd start saying, "And oh, mama," you know, sort of grieving them into a higher purchase. And finally they found out that they'd owe mama themselves into an $800 funeral at a time when a $200 funeral was considered significant. So the only regulations are statewide in this era. They're statewide. They're set by the embalmers themselves. The only regulations beside that are going to be the requirement of a death certificate at death. There are some investigations from the federal government in the 20s and 30s about the high price of funerals, but they're not focused on Southerners. And in fact, many funeral directors will be considered, you know, they're considered personal friends. Mm-hmm. It's one of the stories that I am learning is that funeral directors are a special group of people who really understand their business. I interviewed Ravonda Rucker the other day, and the way she sees her job as being that person who guides a family to the worst couple days of their lives, and she keeps it together and keeps them together, mm-hmm. people recognize that. And so funeral directors, I'm learning, are just these remarkable people in these communities.
I would expect it to be especially true in the African-American community, especially in the era you're going to be studying when there were some white funeral directors who wouldn't touch a black body, just wouldn't touch it.
Well, and there's plenty of white funeral directors who will want the money.
Mm.
But they will treat the black families very poorly. And in fact, many professional black funeral directors will come into business because they want their care of the dead to be far less, not so egregious, mm-hmm. that it should be respectful. So one of the things they did is that they referred to all their clients as Mr. and Mrs. Well, in the white community, you never refer to a black person by white Mr. or Mrs.
Mm-hmm.
And so here's a simple act of respect at the worst moment in your life.
Does the South, for purposes of your research, take in New Orleans? Because I imagine the state of Louisiana, because the jazz funeral is an experience in and of itself.
It is, and I've done some reading Louis Armstrong's autobiography, and I'll eventually get down to New Orleans. and Baton Rouge. One of the things that I'm also finding is that the practices are pretty diverse depending on which part of the South you're in. So South Carolina has some pretty significantly different things than Tennessee, than Mississippi, which is starting to shade into more Catholic practices. So by the time I get to New Orleans, I will have that story there too that I'll need to be finding, certainly.
And with regard to public health policy, was this the era in which states and counties started to have health departments? Did they even have health departments prior to this era?
If they did, and Murfreesboro would have been one of the cities in this, an experimental city, it was funded by external sources, private charities. And in this case, our public health department was built in the 1920s by the Rockefeller Foundation. The New Deal is the one that makes it every county, or helps build it and then fund a social worker.
Do you have a timeline for when you expect to have everything wrapped up and ready to go to press?
No. The grant is a 2-year research grant. It includes an oral interview project with funeral directors. It's going to take some time to get through a lot of that stuff. I hope to have it done within the next 4 years.
Well, I would like to have you back on in 4 years, God willing, we're both still here, to talk about the book and what you've discovered.
Thank you.
The research project is called Just Enough to Put Him Away Decent, The Management of Death and the Evolution of Public Health Policy in the South, 1918 to 1945. Dr. Chris McCusker, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.